Hello, Catherine here. If you're listening to my podcast because you're a fan of wintering, the good news is that my new book, Enchantment, is available now. It's a book about how we can find a way to reconnect with a world that's sometimes hard to live in and even to find magic there. It's available in all good bookshops and please support your local indie if you can. For more information, you can go to catherine-may.com/enchantment. Happy reading.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, everyone. I'm Catherine. Welcome to How We Live Now. I'm standing in my garden underneath the big ash tree that overhangs it, and I'm listening to the wind ruffle the leaves. It's one of my favourite sounds. There's two ring-necked doves a little higher up. They're cooing away. On Saturday, they got chased out of the tree by a very angry squirrel who lives up there too. And I heard him scolding them. It was very, very funny. Today, all is peaceful, but it is beginning to feel a little bit like autumn. It hasn't yet. Even last night, I ate my dinner outside in the pitch dark. Such a strange thing to live through. These profound changes in our weather systems. And of course here in England, we don't feel the worst of it. Anyway, I'm back with a new season of How We Live Now. I had a nice little break over the summer when I really, really needed to take a bit of a rest. Not just to restore my energy, although that was very important. I'd done an awful lot of talking in the first half of the year promoting my new book, Enchantment, and I was beginning to feel a little weary of social contact, as you know I do. But also, during that time, I'd really got so far from the habit of writing that I began to wonder if I could ever get back into it again. It's so easy in this world to put creativity aside, even for someone like me whose career has writing at its centre. There's always an email that needs to be replied to or a meeting that needs to be had, someone who wants to have a cup of tea and pick your brains about something. Somewhere to go, somewhere to be, someone to talk to. And the writing feels like the least substantial part of that. And I had this kind of big realisation at the beginning of summer that only I could fight to put writing at the centre of what I do. And that meant truly honouring it myself, truly believing it wasn't a silly, embarrassing thing that I do on my own and that everything else is proper work. It might surprise some of you to know that that attitude hits me too, and it does. We grow up with a vision of work that often involves salaries and regular hours and going to an office and career progression, pay rises, promotions, limited holiday, very fixed hours. And most of all, that pay comes from hours put in. That's not how writing really works. Most writers, for most of their career, don't get paid anything like the value of their work in creative or cultural terms, or the value of the hours they put in. And for me, it's completely disconnected. It's taken me a long time to integrate that, but I've been working really, really hard on it. And I think that's a good moment to mention that there's a little bit of a change happening in the podcast for this season, at least, in that I'm still pausing a tiny bit and I'm sharing with you something that's already going on in my world elsewhere on the internet, on my Substack, which is katherinemay.substack.com. It's called The Clearing. And one of the things I do on The Clearing is run a book club called the True Stories Book Club, which is a way of talking about the best non-fiction books that are coming out, and particularly non-fiction books that tell quite personal stories. And so for this season, I'm going to share with you the recordings of those True Stories Book Clubs, the interviews I do. Oh, big crowd of doves have just flown over. That was really cool. I hope you heard the wing beat. That was lovely. Sorry, I will carry on. I'm going to share with you the interviews that I do with the authors of the books in our book club. Now, over on Substack for paid subscribers, you're able to attend these live, to attend the recordings, to submit questions, to talk to the author in the chat and to really be part of it. And if you want to join that, then you're really, really welcome. Please take a look at it. But it's also possible to watch those video recordings afterwards and to listen to the audio without any advertising. However, what's great about this podcast is it's free for everyone to listen to if you can tolerate a few ads, which I think we're all used to now. So I hope you really enjoy it. And I want to introduce to you my first guest this season, who is a fantastically poised and accomplished debut author called Erica Berry, talking about her book, Wolfish. Now, Wolfish is quite a hard book to describe, but it's absolutely wonderful. It is a book about the reintroduction of wolves into the Midwest of America and the reactions to that and the survival and the progress of the wolves. It's also about the history and culture of our relationship with wolves and how we see them, about the way they enter our language in so many different ways, the way they enter our folklore, the way they enter our films and our books and our TV programmes, and how absolutely saturated our culture is in the image of the wolf. But there's a third element to this book which I think makes it really special, and that is Erica's own discussion of her experiences as a woman in the world, being predated, feeling like prey, having to understand that there are metaphorical wolves out there as well as literal wolves, but also thinking about what a nuanced and complex relationship that is, about how we become predator sometimes as well as prey, and about how we often choose to fit into those roles rather than resist them. I don't think I'm really doing it justice in my description, but Erica does in our conversation, and I absolutely love speaking to her, and I hope you'll really enjoy it too. Do read the book and do let me know what you think. I'll be back in a little while. Mm. Erica, welcome. It is so lovely to have you here. I'm thrilled that you agreed because it's such a wonderful book that we're talking about today. I'm going to hold my copy up of Wolvish. And I think some people here will have a different cover. So I love it when we get to talk about covers as well, because it's fascinating.
Me too.
So I wondered if you'd like to start us off by reading a little bit from it, giving us a taste of Wolvish.
Thank you. Yes, I've just been flipping. This is the UK version, which I just adore this cover. So this is from the beginning of a chapter that's about the idea of truth and sort of specifically the idea of crying wolf was what I was thinking about. There is a story my gramps likes to tell about one of my early visits to his sheep farm. I must have been 2 or 3, toddling. We're walking toward the barn and I am running ahead in grass already mowed to fuzz by the herd, probably chasing butterflies, those ones that appear each spring to surf the breeze like shreds of torn lavender tissue paper. I turn a corner, round a hill, and stop. I've seen something. Made eye contact with it. Gramps, I say, breathless, running back to his ambling frame, his boots nearly my height. A wolf. There's an animal ahead, eyes glassy but alert, neck hooked in a metal snare trap. As an environmentalist, my gramps believed in the conservation of wild spaces and their inhabitants, but here on the farm he was a tender, and he reckoned those two aims with little angst. His responsibility for the sheep was love, but also business. His job was to keep the flock alive. On the ground, from a distance, the animal is my size, and for a second we watch each other, her breath surely labored. Did she know she would die? Did I? It's not a wolf. Gramps knows that immediately. There are no known wolves in Oregon at this point in the early 1990s. My wolf is just a coyote. But I am a child and I know only stories, and the wolf in my stories looms big. The wolf is the beast that gets the sheep, and I love the lambs. I lean over the rose-colored bathtub and help bottle feed the ones whose mothers have, for whatever reason, turned away. What did I feel watching that predator? I would like to think I cried on instinct, aware I was witnessing a brink of death, but I'm not sure. There is a chance I may have felt like we had won, like this was the last threat, like we had saved the lambs. Or maybe, and this is worse to consider, I saw the animal I thought was wolf, and I did not realize that we had won. Maybe I thought the animal was still a threat, so I ran to grab my grandfather's hand. Maybe I saw panic in the animal's eyes and mistook it for my own. Gramps does not have answers to tell me about what happened after I got him. When I asked recently, he waved it off, eyes floating elsewhere. He began to tell another story. So many of his stories are tall, stretched, sculpted. Does it go without saying I have no memory of the encounter with the trap? No memory of the creature I thought was wolf? No memory of what twitched inside me when, if, I rounded the corner, alone, and looked her in the eye. In French, the word loup means wolf, but in other contexts, it can also mean other things. An error in calculation, for example. Pluralized, it's the black velvet mask worn at a costume ball. Both definitions suggest one's first impression of a wolf is wrong, or rather, imperfect. The truth is not always what it seems.
That is such a perfect introduction to the book. Thank you so much. I mean, one of the things that struck me over and over again was the way that the language of wolves is absolutely knitted into not just our language, but so many other languages across the world. It seems like it's a sort of enduring obsession of humans almost. Mm-hmm.
Well, and I think that was, I sort of thought, like, when you say wolf in America and England, people get this sort of big bad wolf sort of stereotype if they've been raised in a certain Western folkloric sort of biblical tradition. And I started trying to figure out, like, when did that conflation of wolf with bad, scary thing sort of start? And you go back in the language and in Prussian and Slavic and Iranian, like, there are words for wolf that are the words for outlaw. Really, really a long time ago, you know, and this idea that some of these metaphoric conflations that I had sort of thought were these kind of contemporary problems, you realize they're really sort of like deeply in a lot of certain linguistic traditions, not all of them, of course, and that became interesting.
Yeah, and that threat is so often entirely imaginary, as your clip that you just read there suggested, that we project wolves onto things that are not wolves so often. And at the same time, we fail to see the dangerous things that are lurking around us all the time.
Yeah, I became so interested in the idea of how often we define ourselves off of creating this other thing, like that's over there and that's what it's doing. So we must be this civilized, this more rational, I don't know, whatever it is, those projections go so deep with the wolf. And I think, you know, I started this project looking at wolves from a sort of environmental studies standpoint. And I was trying to understand some of the animosity toward wolves in my own family, which is sort of includes taxidermists and ranchers and also environmentalists. And just understanding that when people said wolf, there was this just like shadow wolf beneath it. It was sort of the tip of the iceberg was when people, you'd see a headline about a wolf. And beneath that iceberg was like just these deep feelings about what it meant to be in community, but also to have an other and to have, you know, these boundaries between what is safe and what is dangerous. And the things we are told to fear are so often, that's like a story sold to us. And I became very interested in sort of not just how do we grow out of our fears, which was often how I heard fear talked about, but how do we grow into them? And what would investigating that idea of like inheriting fears, how might that help live with them?
So before we get too deep into the book, I'd love to know a little bit more about your origins as a writer, because this is an astonishingly kind of poised and authoritative debut. Where did you begin as a writer? How did this start? And at what point did you decide to write the book?
Thank you. First, it means so much to have it in your hands. I was a poet first. I think that was the sort of attention to language and the specificity of that as a teenager. And, you know, I think I was reading things like Sylvia Plath's journals because I was like, I'm, you know, this poet, I'm interested in how she's putting voice to women's experience. And it was then reading, say, journals that I was like, oh, it's really interesting when she's also writing about her own life and understanding it, but also sort of there's this porousness between looking at the self and looking at the world. And I became very interested in the idea that, you know, I could look outward and I was curious and I was sort of doing journalism at the same time and was interested in having these interviews, but it was often in service of knowing myself. And I think, you know, if you'd have told me I'd have written a nonfiction book that would be on like the mythology shelf or the science shelf as a kid, it's on all of these different bookshelves, but I would have been very surprised because I was so deep into stories and writing fiction and poetry were really my love at the beginning. But then, you know, this project was sort of in the rock tumbler of my mind for about 10 years. And I think I just needed to really, it was like circling this wolf in many ways. And my first iteration was I'm going to do this kind of cool reported project that's I'm going to solve all the problems of the American West that I've feel deeply in these own family tensions in my own life. And I'm going to sort of write this book for the people who are fighting. And then it was like, well, we'll talk more about this, but these things were happening in my personal life. And I realized I had to look at these things closer to me. And that was the lens through which I was sort of doing the journalism. I was like wearing these glasses of my own experience that I couldn't take off. And so this sort of genre of that, you know, your work is very much inspiring in of being able to like do this sort of weave where you're both being quite intimate about my own life. That felt appealing to me. I guess I was writing what I was trying to figure out at all points.
That's what helps to deliver the kind of symbolic heft of this book, you know, that it's very different to just explaining the folklore of the wolf and the kind of linguistic clout of the wolf. It's the use of your story that really brings that to life. I would love to hear a little more about like some, you know, how you came to decide on those incidents. Because as I was reading about these different encounters with different men that you delve into, I mean, I think any female reader in particular would find it impossible not to be conjuring all the different encounters that they've had. And I mean, it's hard not to notice the commonality of all of our experiences there. But I wonder how you selected them, because I suspect that all of us have got many, many, many of them to tell.
Yeah. You know, I think there's this book also follows the story of one wolf who left his home pack in Oregon. And the only reason we sort of follow this one wolf is that he was the first one, he was wearing a collar. And so scientists were able to track his locations through GPS. And in a way, I think I see my stories in this as I just putting a collar on myself and tracking these little micro movements. And it's not that my story's been any, like, there's nothing really superlative. As you say, these are quite quotidian, some of the experiences. And that does not mean they're not traumatic. They don't reshape your sort of experience of moving through the world, but they're so, the women's experiences and sort of exposure to predatory patriarchal behavior gets so normalized. And early on, I had written a scene with someone that's not in this book. You know, as you say, there are many to pick from. And an advisor sort of said, well, this is really just, this is a pretty standard assault.
Sorry, I shouldn't laugh. But
I know. I just thought, like, it's those so two words together. Yeah. What does it possibly mean that we've standardized a certain encounter so deeply that this cat would be not worthy of writing about because it's a standard assault? And so at a certain point, I thought, like, actually, you know, there are some things that are harder to write about, that are feel like worse things that happen that are not in this book. And some of that is because things that are in here are sort of, there is an everydayness to some of them. They're encounters that happen when we're riding buses, when we're walking down the street. And trying to capture that, you know, I had a sociology professor who said, we make this familiar strange. And I started thinking, like, what would it be like to try to, like, create this granular texture in making the familiar experience of, like, to me, what often felt like hauling around my sort of, like, adolescent as I was coming into womanhood, this body that I, like, didn't know how to have. I had sort of really enjoyed being this sort of, like, asexual tomboy child. And I didn't know what to do with the fact that I was, like, desiring attention and also running into experiences where I felt very uncomfortable. And sometimes those were happening simultaneously. And, like, I just didn't know what to do with any of that. And so trying to write, yeah, those moments. And I think I went into this book thinking I'm going to write about real wolves and that's all I'm going to write about. And then very quickly I got to graduate school and had this experience where I was grabbed on the sidewalk. I do write about this by a man one night who I didn't know. And he grabbed me from behind and didn't let go. And another stranger intervened. But I realized that the way I was moving through the world, like, I'd previously been this sort of off-leash dog, just, like, running around, feeling very adventurous. And it was this turning point where I felt like I was suddenly, like, very skittish. And I was moving through space in a different way. And that changed my relationship with my body, but also with nature and with new people and all of that. And I started thinking about Little Red Riding Hood. And I was like, I don't want to think about Little Red Riding Hood. It's the story that has trapped the wolf in a certain narrative. And it's also, I began to realize, has trapped a certain version of what it means to be a young woman going out, walking at night, going out alone. And I didn't like that narrative. I was uncomfortable with it. But I started thinking, like, what were my Little Red Riding Hood moments? And how have they sort of changed the course that I'm charting?
Yeah. It's funny because when I think about Little Red Riding Hood, the version that I know the best is the Roald Dahl version. I don't know if you know it, but I learned to recite it when I was 10 years old for a brownie guide convention because I have always been this rock and roll. It's been like a consistent thread that's run through my life and I can still recite it now. But in that version, Little Red Riding Hood is the predator. And she suddenly shoots the wolf without giving, you know, away a very exciting ending and turns him into a coat. And I think, I won't recite it now.
I really want it. And also, I can't believe I haven't revisited this recently. I'm sure I read it.
Oh, well, there you go. But that, it's really interesting to compare those versions of Red Riding Hood because that's the truth that you're circling in this book, that we are both predator and prey, and our fear, our very real fear of what a hungry wolf can do turns us into something much more dangerous than the wolf. Mm-hmm. And that cycle then kind of seems to repeat itself.
Yeah.
And there's something in this book about the inescapability of those cycles of fear and of then violence that we enact.
Mm-hmm. No, that's beautifully said. I mean, I do think I felt uncomfortable feeling like a prototypical victim in the narrative. And a lot of that was just thinking about, you know, that is about unpacking my sort of gender identity, unpacking my whiteness. There's many layers of that. And I, at the same time, I was uncomfortable thinking of myself as predatory in that presence too. And of course we're both. And I, thinking about the wolf in a way helped me understand like some amount of fear towards this wild animal makes sense. And I can also feel some amount, or like, you know, it's useful to not think of a wolf like a pet or a dog, I think, right? There's some like, we have to respect that. But also I can feel fear for this creature. And I feel like I was really thinking about that with humans and climate change. And like, I feel both afraid and also afraid for. And that is sort of, that paradox was not always explored in some of these like black and white fear narratives. And I think about like, you know, talking to a biologist who told me this story about he'd been following one wolf with a collar that was sort of this master, big alpha wolf kind of in Yellowstone. The idea of the alpha wolf is challenged, I should say, with a footnote, but it was this big wolf. And he said, one day he finds it, the collar shows that the wolf is dead, and he goes and tracks it and finds it in the middle of a snowy field. And this wolf is lying there with a spattering of blood around him. And he's like, what has happened here? We've got this dead wolf, a circle of blood. And he realizes the wolf has two holes in its side where an elk has just skewered it with its antlers and sort of spun it around and tossed it. And that was a phenomenal story because he said, like, what we don't realize is that the prey needs more credit. Like the prey can be really fierce. And in that moment, like, who is the predator? Who is the prey? And even like thinking about stories like that in the natural world helped me sort of think about the ways that even when I've been had some of these encounters on the street, like, you know, it's not a clear, I had certain predatory privileges or certain experiences that made me feel bad perhaps for the person, even as I was very threatened by them. And I felt like that is a hard thing to write into because it's sort of a sense of uncertainty in my own voice. But I felt like that was important to share.
Yeah, absolutely. It wasn't until I was writing Wintering that I got curious about why we no longer have wolves. And I had not understood that we had eradicated them so very deliberately. You know, I'd assumed that they'd kind of, I don't know, gradually died off due to habitat change, or I don't know. I suppose I hadn't thought about it that deeply. But I'd not realized like the systematic way that our society and others have hunted down the wolf. And, you know, the fact that we've definitely done the wolf more harm than it has ever done to us. And of course, as in, you know, as in America, there are now some people that are advocating very strongly for bringing wolves back into the environment. For anyone that hasn't geeked out about wolves to the extent that you and I have, can you outline the arguments for bringing wolves back? Like, I think from a sort of standing point, you'd maybe think, well, why on earth would we do that? But there's actually some very good reasons that people are considering it.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of this idea that the landscapes that we're both in have been shaped by the eradication of wolves was really interesting to me, like swamps in New England drained, and you have reports of forests in Ireland being burned for this. And so this idea of sort of getting rid of the vermin was often the language, like it justified all of the way that our world really looks on an environmental history level, but also social history, you know, eradication of indigenous people or, you know, expulsions. Those narratives were so tied. And so I think to some degree, repopulation of wolves is related to this idea of not just going back to it. There's no sort of stable wilderness, but it is thinking about what does it mean to go back to sort of think about the ways that colonizing forces have really altered a certain balance in the ecosystem. And in America, especially out of Yellowstone, there's been many studies about how wolves, they sort of change the ecologies of fear, and these sort of beautiful terms that I sort of look at metaphorically too, but landscapes of fear, where you have wolves affecting how elk are going to be feeding. Maybe they're a bit more skittish, so they're eating fewer saplings. And then you have birds that are living in those saplings. And, you know, scientists are careful to say that some of these studies that happen in Yellowstone would not, it's too simplistic to say that like wolves are just going to save songbirds all over the world. But I do think they are a part. There's this Keystone Predator that their connections into all of these things. Now it's being tested out in really interesting ways. There's fewer cars hitting deer in Wisconsin because the deer are staying away from the roads where there are wolves. So there was a really interesting study out of Wisconsin that was trying to put sort of a number on, here's how many like car accidents. Like we can, if we reintroduce wolves, will prevent car accidents because so many people hit deer. And, you know, there's research about deer having this chronic wasting disease. It's called this illness where that can affect hunters. It can be a brain related thing. You don't really eat deer with this illness, but wolves will pick out the sick number of deer in a herd. And like that might be positive. Yeah. So there's sort of all this new research now about the ways that like we have not understood the myriad ways that predators in our ecosystem do sort of help maintain this balance. And, you know, an animal dying at the hands of a wolf is sometimes less cruel than dying because there's just not enough food because there's the herd is too big. You know, I thought a lot about this idea of like, what is the cruelty of losing an animal to a wolf, to dying by a predator? Like wolves are not cruel when they kill. That's what they do. That's why the metaphor of humans as wolves falls flat. One of those reasons. And of course, like the other side of that is wolves do not understand that this is ranch and that is wilderness, and they do predate, and you have circumstances where wolves will sort of like learn that there's a sheep herd and continue to come back. But I've talked to a number of livestock producers in Oregon where I live and Montana where I have family, and you know, there's electric fences around their territories that really prevent wolves coming in. And there are ways that people have been living beside wolves. So I am on the side of like, this is not a thing we haven't done. This is for many thousands of years, people have lived beside wolves.
I mean, one of the things that came to mind for me when I was reading your book was, I just wonder if like agriculture is a bit incompatible with a world that has wolves in. You know, it's a as you say, it's a system that the wolves can't read. They can't see that this group of livestock belongs to this human. And it's like, you know, we've overlaid this patterning over the landscape and the wolves are still using it in a much more ancient way. But I think we find it, like particularly at this point in history, more than any other time, I think we find it incredibly hard to understand that a predator that eats and kills other animals could be beneficial. Like we don't have the same relationship to cruelty as we used to, or to death, or to suffering. Like we are so hypersensitive to those things happening in the animal kingdom. And yet weirdly, we seem very mellow about it happening within human populations quite often. It just boils up all of these contradictions that come from us and not the wolves. The wolves are behaving pretty consistently. They're being wolves.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's beautifully said. I think like this, the putting the cost on everything, it's this competitive instinct where we have that we are supposed to make this amount of money from these cattle. And if the wolves are stealing it, they're like taking our money. But, you know, it reminds me of some ranchers I talked to who were saying like, if wolves are in our pasture, that means that deer are in our pasture. And that means it's like the deer are happy. Mm. And actually they were saying, we want to raise cattle in a place where wolves want to be because that shows us it's a healthy ecosystem. And so they've hired a tracker who kind of is with the ranch, and he sort of, okay, we're getting some predatory behavior. Let's have the wolves, you know, let's have the cows cluster together in a different way and keep each other safe, right? Like there's different patterns of agriculture. And that's part of it, is that that's just sort of gone. Mother cows around wolves will learn to take care of their young in a different way and to teach fear and to teach protection. And that was also quite poignant for me in animal and human contexts. Like the threats are not necessarily gone, but when we're living around them and acknowledging certain things, we like learn how to adapt and live beside potentially in different ways. And, you know, many of the animals, livestock that are being bred right now are not bred to be smart. They're bred to be a certain amount of fat in the market and, you know, capital, they're these docile.
Yeah.
And how could we sort of, I think the wolf can maybe push our food system in interesting ways, and much less our relationship between, you know, my property and their property. And like, that's all, that all is a bit rusty and, you know, a very colonial mindset. So as you say, how can the wolf help us think about interconnection more broadly? Because the wolf does kind of walk in and out of many of our different systems.
Mm. Talk to me a little bit about the link between wolves and colonialism, or the parallels that you draw, because that for me was a really fascinating part of the story. I mean, I think particularly understanding that Indigenous communities have often got a very different picture of what a wolf is, but also, you know, this kind of way that we have, again, you know, been the symbolic wolves in this area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really didn't really understand that there was a link until I was researching the history of my home state of Oregon. And I found that the first meetings, the first sort of government meetings were about putting a tax bounty on predators to kill wolves, essentially. And it was going to say, here's what we'll pay if someone brings in this wolf pelt. So, okay, my state was founded on the expulsion of wolves. That was shocking to me. But then researching a little bit more and understanding that the sort of next round of laws passed were Black exclusion laws, they're called, which was really like only white people are allowed in this state. And understanding that it would have been the same people voting, like no wolves, no people of color, no Asian Americans. And that was really, I just began to see the ways that those conflations in the language go back so far and were really embedded absolutely inextricably in the founding of nationhoods and statehoods. Mm-hmm. And, you know, early national parks in the States, you had these game wardens who were chasing out not only wolves, but the Blackfeet people who were hunting as well. And it was just this real effort to control who was allowed to hunt, who was allowed to kill, who was allowed to profit off of the land, right? And I think in so many of these stories, like there's research onto how wolves maybe helped humans were looking to wolves and learning how to hunt in certain ways from them. Like the idea that we're these really close, you know, there's so many similarities between wolf packs and human communities, the ways that they care for young, you know, you have sort of auntie figures, you stepchildren, right? Foster families, like all of these groupings are actually terms that biologists will use to talk about wolf packs. And the understanding that humans have known that for thousands of years and been watching wolves and learning from them at the same time that a sort of Western colonial mindset was like, we have to differentiate. This is a threat to us, you know, and trying to figure out the seed of like, why was the wolf so threatening? Why did we, you know, a white settler perspective, why so much torture of this creature that you really don't necessarily see with like even mountain lions, cougars, some of these other big predators. There's something very specific about the wolf. Mm-hmm. And I do think part of that is this sort of, this is my more theory, but the dog-likeness of it, but it's foreign, right? It doesn't respond to us. And this idea that like, it's not man's best friend. It doesn't really care about us. The wolf is living its own life. And that is hard for this sort of mindset of everything has to be in service of me. You know, Western domination of nature feeling. Yeah.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at UH1.com.
That struck me a lot as well, this kind of idea that a wolf is a sort of wrong dog almost. And we like dogs as a human population. And therefore, this kind of slight deviance or divergence is incredibly uncomfortable to us. And like, I'm quite a recent dog owner. I never thought I'd be a dog person. And I rescued a dog a couple of years ago. And it's just been fascinating living with this creature who is on one hand so kind of loving and obedient towards us, but on the other hand has this nature that kind of comes out in her sometimes. And that's particularly when she's approached by other dogs. She will suddenly snarl, and it's really, really shocking. And in particular, if I'm with her and we're approached by a lone man, her hackles will go up. She'll start growling. It's so interesting that she identifies the same threats that I identify. Mm-hmm. But first of all, I thought she was just kind of a mongrel. But as I read about her, she's from Greece.
Okay.
And she's actually quite a specific breed called a Greek shepherd. And she's bred to defend the pack against wolves. That's what her kind of genetic role is. And so she is incredibly hostile to other dogs because that is exactly what she's been like put on this earth to do. And that sort of really changed the way I saw her, because now when we're walking through the woods and she'll suddenly pause and like look around and growl, and I'll be like, Fraggle, there's no wolves here, you know, but she's on the alert for wolves all the time.
That hypervigilance. I'm curious if being around a dog like that has made you feel like an animal in different ways. Like, I've thought a lot about what looking at a wolf, like part of it is learning to see this other animal, but part of it is seeing myself as an animal and understanding the sort of codes. Yeah, I'm just curious how that's affected. Do you feel like we're just these two animals ever?
Yeah, and that struck me so early on when I got her, because when we rescued her, she'd been like very badly injured and then turned out into the street. So she had a very badly broken leg, and we shipped her right over to the UK. She was like 4 months old, and yeah, it was a big to do. And when I could finally take her for a walk in the woods and take her off the lead,
yeah.
I had there was snow on the ground all in between the trees. And I just had this extraordinary moment of walking with my dog in the woods, and both and the freedom that she clearly felt. And she was like snuffling through all the leaves and digging and you know, really looking around. And there was, I don't know, I don't want to overstate it, but it felt like there was something very ancient there of like a human and a dog walking together. And it was this really sort of transcendent moment for me. Yeah, there was something that we understood about each other, and something that she like opened up for me in that territory when I was there with her, as opposed to when I was there alone.
Yeah. Well, I've thought about that too, just being around some small children recently. I don't have children, but my friends, and like the ways that there's sort of an attention to sensory detail that I would pass over. And similarly, like being around animals, and I spent a couple of weeks observing wolves and just watching the ways that like what a bird means, that is all sort of re-altering my experience of being a body in the world in a way that's really beautiful. And I was just on a panel about like why write about animals right now in our sort of time of extinction, like what can it gain us by writing about animals? And I think part of it is like, it's an exercise to try to think about how do I describe the world as a wolf is seeing it? Like a wolf leaves these sort of olfactory breadcrumbs as it walks, right? And so a wolf is going to sort of know who else was walking there. And that's just this like layer of beautiful kind of what would seem like telepathy or magic to me. But knowing that has changed the way that I walk through the woods, because I'm starting to imagine and, you know, like who was here and walking with a tracker. I had a similar experience, like he was able to see things that I wasn't. And I think that like granularity of experience feels so, yeah, there's something so enlivening about that, that we can get from thinking with wolves or dogs.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, I always think about the sort of archaeological research that suggests that ancient hunters probably tried to enter the minds of their prey. You know, we can see it in cave paintings, we can see it in artifacts that seem to have turned people into deer, for example. And there, it seems that, you know, whereas now we would only hunt as like an act of domination in general, you know, it's in Western societies, it's done for fun and for sport and as this kind of expression of like macho-ness in quite a grim way. Mm-hmm. The ancient roots of hunting appeared to be much more about respecting the animal that we hunted, but also like to the extent that we became it, like inhabiting it, and this sort of merging between the self and the prey that kind of suggests this sort of absoluteness of the ecology, I guess, this complete intertwining of the ecology. And there's something that feels
really interesting. Well, and if you look back, research like shepherd societies were more the wolf was bad, but hunter societies were really looking to the wolf. And I just think that way, the idea that what a wolf means depends on sort of the capitalist or the agricultural system that you're in is so interesting. And like, I was really struck by some stories from northeastern Japan hundreds of years ago, where if you're growing rice, the wolf is the one scaring the deer. So the wolf is someone to be thanked. And there's these shrines to wolves. And like the wolf becomes a sort of shepherd in that category. And just this idea that the wolf could be this sort of sacred tender in the way that growing up near a sheep farm, the wolf is the problem. The wolf is the right, but that's not innate. That's a story that we tell, and recognizing those stories, it becomes useful. And also, I think what you were saying earlier about the dog is familiar, but the wolf is sort of this gone rogue version. That goes back to the conflations of wolves and women, which go back in ancient Greek texts, and Anne Carson writes about it, this idea of sort of, I want to live beside this thing, but I want to live beside it. And this is a sort of, you know, male voice in a way that is very domesticated and clear, and you are listening to me. And when that sort of version of womanhood acts out, that becomes a threat in the way that the wolf being wild is a threat to that. And so those conflations, they're just there. They're there through hundreds of years.
But at the same time, you know, I think Native American cultures often see the wolf as a symbol of humility.
Absolutely.
And of kind of good motherhood. And there's a lot of gentle attributes, female attributes, I think, or feminine attributes that come with the wolf in some societies.
There totally are. And that idea of this sort of like mother wolf that can be really deeply fierce. And I sort of look at it not just as mother, like a biological mother, but with wolf packs, especially, like everyone will play the mother, you know, other members of the pack will regurgitate food for the young. Like the caretaking is very sort of loosely horizontal in ways that were really inspiring to think about. What can we learn from how wolves take care of one another, right? There's a lot there.
Mm. Well, I just begin to wonder if it isn't the fact that they show their vulnerability to us so much that makes us so angry with them. You know, they're not the perfect predator in that sense. They're not the, I don't know, killing machine, even if we like to portray them as that sometimes in sort of, you know, in this kind of post-wolf society that we live in, where we can imagine a wolf as something other than what it is. I mean, cultures that are intimate with wolves know that they're deeply vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. And you know, most of their hunts are not successful. And, you know, this idea of the lone wolf that goes out alone, it's so often talked about as just this big, scary threat. And yet the time in the wolf's life where the wolf goes out alone is the most vulnerable, right? There's territorial disputes. It's harder to hunt when you can't be sort of doing this beautiful choreography. Watching wolves hunt from up above is sort of extraordinary. Often you have the matriarch leading the pack. You can't do that if you're alone. You're eating roadkill, right? It's a hard time in the life. And the idea that a wolf will go it alone, not as some sort of exercise, and I just am this kind of macho figure, but they're looking for partnership. They're looking for another pack. They're looking for more land. And that was really instructive to me too. Like sometimes the vulnerability and the ferocity are not mutually exclusive. They're often the same, right? And how do we think about, when I think about a lone wolf shooter headline or something, that's the wrong metaphor. But how can what I now know about lone wolves, the animal, the non-human animal, help me think about maybe the human version of that.
Yeah.
Talk to me about wolves and the uncanny, because I think that's how we so often think about them now. You know, they crop up in horror films and in ghost stories. You know, their sound is enduringly eerie to us. You know, there seems to be like this sort of residual memory of what it's like to hear the wolves howling. Talk to me a little bit about that link.
Yeah, there is something that sort of a rancher who I was talking to was like, we always hear wolves and we never see them. And she was sort of saying that's part of the, I think she sort of, she compared it sort of to like having a crush, but there's nothing ever happens. And so you actually think more about that person because they're never really there when you're a teenager or something. And that idea that in the absence, wolves don't want particularly to hang around with us, right? They do their own thing. And that distance creates, again, a sense of illegibility that I think is quite threatening. And it was really interesting sort of looking at some of these werewolf stories. I began to think about there's many sort of like legends of people becoming wolves. And what does that mean? What sort of access to a fierceness that we are not allowed as humans does it mean to want to be? I've started having dreams at a certain point with this book where I was like, I had wolf parts, or I was sort of in that zone liminally between a wolf and a human, and trying to think about like that fantasy of becoming this wolf. That also feels very primal in a way to me. And I don't know what that is. But there are these just so many legacies of people and women having this sort of slippages between becoming a wolf.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like grasping for the particular of the story, but it is for our sort of spooky season that we're in. I do feel like it's sort of this wolf season.
Yeah, it is. It's wolf season. And there is this enduring sense of liminality that trails the wolf. And as you were speaking, I was thinking about how often I'd read wolves as being described as like dissolving into the forest, as if they're non-corporeal, you know, they're like ghosts. There's a merging of the wolf and the wild, and they're kind of inseparable.
Yeah.
It represents a pole of wildness that is almost the ultimate.
Well, and this phrase that sort of becomes one of the backbones, sort of conceptual backbones of the book, entre chien et loup, between a dog and a wolf.
Yes, I love that.
Got this roots in Latin and French, but this idea that when you're walking down a path at sunset, you can't tell maybe if the creature before you is a dog or a wolf. And that idea of not being able to parse if you're sort of right, is your heart right to pound a little bit more? And part of that feeling is maybe fear, anxiety of the unknown. But with the unknown comes excitement too, right? And this sort of intrigue. And I think the inseparability of those feelings, and it wasn't until, so I started thinking about that idea, like how am I, whether it's me walking in the woods and hearing something or me on the sidewalk and hearing footsteps behind me. And I'm thinking, am I right to be really like scared right now? And that evaluating of the fear is such an innate thing. And I was researching how wolves live with fear in their own lives. And, you know, wolf pups are born very fearful. But what does that fear do? It means they hear something under a tree, they go to investigate. And so the fear is always tied to curiosity, to inquiry, to investigation.
Yeah.
And I think in my life, I was thinking sometimes the fear is like closing a door. Like my world got smaller when I was most kind of anxious. But I started thinking about the ways that fear could like open doors too and mean, well, let me go look at this more. Like fear is often a lack of knowledge. And so again, the thing I could learn from the wolf was like sometimes feeling that fear means just like go look at it a little bit more. Of course, you know, not on a dark sidewalk, but there is a processing that the uncanniness can be intriguing, maybe. Yeah.
Well, we talk a lot about reclaiming nighttime spaces and lonely spaces, but I just wonder if sometimes that's naive, you know, the idea that this can somehow be conquered and that we can dispel all the darkness. I don't know if that will ever happen, however hard we fight the patriarchy.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I do think that was, it's so bleak, but I was really raised in this sort of like, girl power, feminism is here, everything's happened, you're fine, like you're safe. And that was many sort of my intersecting privileges and where I was growing up. But it was the first realization that that just wasn't true and that I wanted to toss out Little Red Riding Hood entirely. But some amount of what the mother says to the daughter in the sort of original Grimm's version of that is like, go to grandmother's house, there is a forest, there are wolves, and go. And like that idea of like, go out, even though there's something scary. And I think, you know, I went into this book thinking like, I'm writing this book because I'm trying to evaluate, when am I right to feel fear? What am I right to fear? Like, how do I live with these fears? I was trying to just sort of like collate them and realizing at the end, like, there's no way that I can predict what is happening or when something scary is going to be. So it's like, how do we walk beside that sense of uncertainty and mortality and fear and frustration? And of course, I want to make the world sort of, you know, I'm very pleased when men who've read this book say, a rancher wrote to me and he said, I realized that I was a wolf in my younger days. And I was so surprised because he'd lost more livestock to wolves than anyone in the state of Oregon. You know, I thought he'd react to this book on a sort of wolf cow level. And instead he reacted on I see myself in a certain version of male wolfhood, a big bad wolf, and I'm reckoning with it. And he was having these conversations with his wife. And I'm like, that's really positive. And also,
that's incredible.
You know, these things are still going to be there.
But equally, like, I wonder how many women have ever looked back at themselves and thought, I was a wolf.
That's really interesting.
I find it unrelatable to be able to look back and think that. Wow.
Yeah.
And as I was reading, I was thinking, you know, it was chiming with so much in the news. You know, I was like last week, I was I couldn't help but draw parallels between your book and the revelations about Russell Brand and this man who, to me, it seems like he went out of his way to present himself as wolfish. And we kind of liked it until we didn't, honestly.
The movie Wolf with Jack Nicholson and Michelle Pfeiffer.
Yes.
It's about the publishing industry. It's really wild. And I was just researching, anyway, I was Googling Jack Nicholson for something related to that. And I found a profile of him from 1994. And it was saying, wolfish is in. And Jack Nicholson, like the word wolfish was tied to him. And this idea that this fierceness, it's been sort of defanged by feminism, but now women actually really like this fierce, mean wolf guy. And we're back to that. And I was just thinking about the ways that like wolf and desirability politics have like gone in and out. Yeah. And that's exactly what you're saying about Brand. And like, you know, that's a thing to interrogate as women, as well as, you know, any identity, sort of how are these, what are these figures and archetypes?
Yeah. I mean, that kind of sense that on one hand, you know, there's the wolf as predator, as sexual predator, but there's also that meeting of female desire, which is much more ambiguous than we like to think it is, and which often enjoys that vision of the sort of predatory male to an extent. You know, if you look at research into sexual fantasies, it's just such a common fantasy, but that not being the same as wanting it to actually happen, and how confused we feel about that, like how difficult we find it to really interrogate that and express that. We know when the line has been crossed, mm-hmm. when it happens, but I think we find it quite hard to truly articulate where that line is, and certainly not consistently across the whole of society either.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it makes me think about Angela Carter's Wolf Stories, which I was, you know, looking at some of those early drafts. And I think so often, you know, I was raised very much to like, know when to say no. We were taught no in a sort of sexual consent way, but not yes. It actually, the idea of what to say yes to was really never explored. And that's a lot harder. And I think as we think about like, not just, I don't want to be in a place, so much of the way girls are raised in certain cultures, I think my own, is like, you are the sort of gatekeeper and you are just like pushing, saying no to things. And that is such a lousy way, I thought, to be a young woman, right? Where you're just sort of imagining yourself constantly under siege and just in that process. And I'd much rather be sort of like saying yes and having this eagerness and curiosity and just sort of knowing what I want. And yeah, what new language do we have for that? I think, again, there's the Roald Dahl's example is a beautiful one, because there are these fairy tales that sort of mine this scaffolding that's very familiar and yet build something much more liberating.
I mean, weird that comes from Roald Dahl, but sure.
It is.
If it's offered.
There are other feminist versions.
Yeah. Let's go back to Angela Carter quickly.
Exactly. Yeah.
But yeah, I'm just trying to think of the name of Billie Eilish, who recently was talking about how she realized that porn had taught her to expect some fairly brutal treatment. And I kind of thought, wow, that's shifted yet again. Like, that made me feel really old, because like when I was growing up, like women just didn't often watch porn. And that has definitely changed. Like, by the time I was teaching in university, like, I don't know, 8 years ago, a survey was published that said that at least 1 in 3 women were regularly watching porn. And that really took me by surprise. Like, I specialized in porn research when I was at university doing sociology.
So interesting.
That was like my, I wrote my dissertation on it, and that was like my major interest. I was like, that relationship between women and porn had like completely passed me by. It had changed so very much. But then yet here was Billie Eilish talking about like how she was beginning to look out for the other side of that and think how she'd been trained into expecting this certain, you know, genre of male behavior towards her, and that maybe wasn't an absolute truth. And I thought, wow, there are huge societal shifts around sex and predation happening all the time. And we have so little understanding of it, and we still don't understand what our yes means.
And that idea that the way that we're living and thinking is based on these stories and codes that we've often unconsciously inherited, right? And like the idea, I think about this with like falling in love. We do these scripts when we're young, where, right, like, here's me performing what I should do when I'm going steady with someone. I can picture being 16, but also understanding that when I'm afraid, We're also enacting scripts, or this idea, you know, in sex, we're like enacting stories. And if we're not sort of like interrogating those stories and thinking like, what have I inherited here? What do I want to keep? What do I want to give away? Then we are, you know, we're mistaking sort of free will for actually like being traded and given something, often by a system that's exploitative, capitalist, patriarchal, racist. And like, we have to do that work of sort of excavation, interrogation, I think. Mm. And it's hard.
It's hard, and it's completely vital and inescapable, I think. Like, I don't think we can get anywhere without thinking about this Jungian archetype, really.
Yeah, exactly. Just this idea, when I said the title of the book to my sister, she said, I think of like a big sloppy kiss, like a wolfish kiss, and like this idea that a woman would be wolfish. Wow. Like, a woman's not really wolfish. And I was just really thinking about that as like an idea of like, I'm someone who's like deeply hungry and deeply sort of omnivorous. And I saw that in how I researched this book, but how I sort of move through the world, and like, what does it mean to sort of reclaim that idea of a word that's like too much? There's something sloppy about it, perhaps in a certain stereotype the masculine.
You're not allowed to be too hungry.
You're not, right. Exactly.
I was just going to draw another parallel, really, or ask you what you thought about it. Because in the UK this week, last week, we had a lot in the newspapers about these bully XL dogs, which are a breed of dog that seems to have been bred to emphasize their kind of like physical power and heft. And this is under debate, but perhaps aggression, although a lot of people would say that it depends on how the dog is raised and trained and treated. What does it say about us that we are breeding scariness? Let's use the word scariness to like encapsulate all of that into dogs and inviting that into our home. Or not all of us, clearly, but some.
Yeah, I mean, I hate to say that it makes me, the first thing I think of is the sort of video camera surveillance state that's become so normalized here, where every porch you're really told like someone will steal your packages. So you've got to put up this camera. Yeah. And there's a mistrust of neighbors, right? They're strangers, they're not neighbors, right? And I think there is a degree of like, you need to protect yourself. I just thought so much about the ways that I was told to protect myself and distrusted those. Just because I think something's scary doesn't mean it's a threat, you know? And this is true for a man on the sidewalk. Like, the gap between perceiving something as predator and actually them being predator. And so, you know, a dog like that, it seems like that's such a deep story about the stories we're telling about each other and the fact that we're in a world where people think they're under siege from each other instead of seeing our commonalities, our interconnectivities, right?
So you need a dog that's a weapon that kind of aggrandizes you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So just to close, I had a question sent in from Jojo, who asked what you were writing next. The traditional question that we all want to know. Tell us, where'd you go after Wolves?
Well, I'm writing about love, not fear now. And I think in some ways the question of like, I was writing this book to try to deal with how to live with my fears. And now I'm far less hypervigilant and I'm much more comfortable living beside it. And, you know, I don't think a book always solves your problems, but there is a degree of puzzling it over enough. And so the question I was then left with was like, the world is still scary. It's going to be scary. The future scares me. And yet it's not a reason not to connect and love each other. And I've been thinking about sort of the way love in the face of uncertainty looks different, and climate change in particular, and how animals are changing what they're doing and adapting, and they're mating and they're in relation to each other in different ways, I will say, whether it's marmots are suddenly, there's more infidelity among the marmots. Like, what does that say about how take care? I know.
They're so cute. How can they be mean to each other?
Maybe it's not a bad thing. I don't, you know, we got to get inside the marmot heads, but.
So I'm being very judgmental of the marmots. I'm so sorry.
No, but this is the thing that I relate really hugely. Certain birds being too tired to do their mating rituals because it's so hot. And so there are these, I'm looking at this animal world and thinking also about the sort of questions and stories that I've inherited about love and what it means to be in relation as we're moving into a period of deeper, perhaps, unrest and uncertainty. But I think it's so important to be thinking about these sort of love stories and connections, because that's a way of visualizing an excitement in the future. That's always been there for me. And I'm thinking about, like, I do feel like things are quite dire environmentally. But I also feel like this really strong sense of like hope and sort of like ongoingness that I'm trying to kindle. So looking into that.
That sounds absolutely amazing. And please send me an early copy. I'm getting in the queue.
Fingers crossed it becomes anything and not my serial killer scribbles on a giant piece of paper, you know, on my wall.
Erica, I would read those. Thank you so much. It's just been amazing to talk to you. And I hope everybody reads this incredible book. I just loved it. So congratulations.
Thank you so much, Catherine.
Thank you all for being here. It's always so, so great to see you. But for now, very good night. And thank you again.
Thank you. Take care, everyone.
Well, welcome back. Wasn't that just great? I absolutely love running this non-fiction focused book club, which is quite a rare thing. So many book clubs are really about fiction books. But I just adore getting the chance to meet the authors behind my favourite new books and to really being able to have a conversation with them about what makes them tick, how they think, and finding those interesting corners where our work relates. It's fun out there, isn't it? Get to do lots of things. I find that a problem, frankly. There are too many good things to do, and I have to learn to cut down a bit. As you can hear, I'm a little bit hoarse after a week of talking to interesting people on various podcasts. It's one of the big challenges of this world, is knowing how much to do, knowing when to stop, knowing when to take a break. But we're just moving towards winter now, towards the dark half of the year. And that is, as you know, my favourite time of the year. And I love that it invites us towards a slowing down of pace and a reframing of who we are as people during that time when everything feels that little bit quieter, that little bit more peaceful, that little bit more domestic. Anyway, I hope you enjoy this new season. If you'd like more information on Erica's book, do check out my Substack, which is catherinemay.substack.com. And I'll see you very soon. Bye. And that's all for this episode. Thanks for being here to explore how we live now. This podcast is presented by Catherine May, produced by Megan Hutchins and Buddy Peace, with social media by Sarah Horner and communications by Becca Pierce. Buddy Peace also composed the wonderful incidental music. For updates, show notes, transcriptions and plenty of stories, subscribe to my newsletter at catherinemay.substack.com, where you can also upgrade to support the show and join my vibrant community of readers, writers and wanderers. And finally, if you enjoyed my podcast, please consider buying my new book, Enchantment. There's a link in the show notes. See you next time.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.